Thank you. Thank you. Good morning and happy Easter to all of you. It's a special privilege and honor to be able to gather with you in this Holy Week. Thank you, President Reese, Vice President Collings, for the generous welcome. I also want to lift up and celebrate, thank you for the invocation and the beautiful music we started with. It's truly special to have the chance to be with you in this weekly occasion of reflection. I've just been learning about this ritual of your time together and think it's so profoundly important. And it's such a gift that you're giving me, I recognize, to take time from your incredibly busy lives to think with me, to reflect with me about how we are with one another. My title today, as you will have seen, is called How to Be a Confident Pluralist. I'm grateful to legal scholar John Inazu for the idea of confident pluralism. I'm building on that. It captures a lot of what my work has been over recent years. But before I get into the work of sharing with you what this mission is, this mission of being a confident pluralist, I want to back up for a moment and share a little bit more about myself, who I am, who is this person who is speaking to you, and how was it that I first met confident pluralists in my own life. So you heard a bit from the introduction. I'm a combination of a Harvard prof and a democracy advocate. When folks ask me what I work on, I always give the same answer. I say democracy, past, present, and future, with no question mark on the end of that. And for me, that's a commitment, a focus I come by super honestly. It is, for starters, a matter of my basic family inheritance. On my dad's side, I had a granddad who helped found one of the first NAACP chapters in Northern Florida in the 40s. That's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. They did incredible work for civil rights, and at the time that my grandfather was doing this work in the 40s, he was literally taking his life into his hands. Lynchings were on the rise at the time. My mom's side, my great-grandparents helped fight for women's right to vote. My great-granddad in 1917 was marching with suffragettes on Boston Common, fighting for that right to give voice, to express views and commitment. So across this group of ancestors, I come from people who were committed to empowerment, to the idea that empowerment is the bedrock for human thriving and well-being. But there is something else about these people that really mattered. They were also all people who were told that something was impossible, that social equality for African Americans in the South was impossible, or that women having the right to vote was impossible. And their answer was, no, these things are not only not impossible, they're necessary. So the only question is how? So often we face hard things that seem to many impossible, but the answer has to be no, they're necessary. And then the question is how? And that's some of what I want to talk about today, how it is we are with others in the world, where it seems almost impossible to forge bonds across lines of difference. But I think that work is necessary, and the question is how? My granddad and my early ancestors were the first examples in my life of confident pluralists, people who knew what mattered to them and why, and were respectful in their engagements with others about those values, but always moving the work forward, moving the cause and purpose forward. But the question of what it really means to be a confident pluralist came home to me most powerfully in lessons that I got from my dad and my aunt. Because of that ancestral inheritance, I grew up in a family of super civically engaged people. We were a big, big family, lots and lots of cousins, and people were engaged all across the political spectrum. There was this one incredible year in my youth, in 1992, when my dad and my aunt were both running for office at the same time. My aunt was on the ballot in the Bay Area of California for the Peace and Freedom Party, the far left side of the political spectrum. And at the very same time, my dad was running for U.S. Senate from Southern California as a Reagan Republican. And they would just get into the most incredible debates over our dinner table, back and forth. My dad, super professorial, skinny, he liked to wear a beret, he was always smoking a pipe, pipe smoke curling around his head. My aunt was a really big woman. She was built like a Mack truck. She had a huge belly laugh. She was gay, very different way of being in the world between the two of them. And they would go back and forth, my dad arguing for market liberties and civic virtues, my aunt arguing for public sector investments in every segment of society and experiments in living. And I was a young person, just back and forth, back trying to figure it out. And it wasn't easy because I knew I loved them both. So how was I supposed to process these ideas and make sense of them? But as I watched them, as I listened to them, two things became very clear to me. For all that they were debating, they actually shared a common purpose. The purpose they shared was this idea that empowerment for a person, for their family, for their community was at the bedrock of human thriving. And then they were disagreeing mightily about how to achieve that common purpose. Real arguments about the how, but they shared that project of empowerment, that ancestral commitment I was describing. The other thing I realized watching them as they went at these ideas with such ferocity was that it was the ideas they were going at, not each other as human beings. It was clear they always had each other's back. They never broke the bonds of love. They held sacred the dignity of the human being in front of them. So those two, my dad and my aunt, were the first confident pluralists that I truly got to know deeply. Each of them very clear about what mattered to them and why they had engaged in practices of reflection. Each of them ready to engage and advance the cause of their commitment, but always, as they did so, holding sacred the dignity of the human being in front of them. It's this spirit, this ethos, that I think that we need more of in our times today. So now what I want to do is share with you in a little bit more detail, a little bit more technical detail, precisely what I mean by this idea of a confident pluralist. I'll give you a definition, and then we'll spend a little bit of time talking about how one can go about being that confident pluralist. Well, the definition you've started to hear already. First of all, there's the point about confidence. Having confidence in what you value, what matters to you, and why. That's about digging deep. It is about practices of reflection. It is not about a sort of superficial sense of preferences. It's about doing the work to understand the reasons behind your commitments. Now, why does that matter so much? It matters because human beings at our best are people who deeply understand our purposes, what's called of us, what is required to bring good into the world. And so as we do that work and become confident in our own sense of commitments, we are also exhibiting that unfolding of the human being, human flourishing, which is so vital to success of our human cause in the world. That's the purpose behind my family's commitments to empowerment, the idea that by providing people with empowerment, we give them the chance to develop in these ways, to become fully themselves as human beings. Now, it's important to recognize that when one supports concepts of empowerment, concepts of self-development in this way, concepts of freedom, because that is what I'm talking about, people will develop different pictures about the good, about what is good for themselves as individuals and what is good in human life. James Madison wrote this in the Federalist Papers, that one of the most important results of freedom is diversity, that when people are free to dig deep and think about what matters to them and why, you will get many different pictures of the good emerging, in fact. So when one is confident in that project of empowerment, that project of self-development, what it means also is one is welcoming a commitment to pluralism. That can seem counterintuitive, but it means that one wants others also to be on their own journey about understanding what matters to them and why. So then this produces an interesting challenge and conundrum. If we're working so hard to understand the good, what we care about, how on earth then do we also function in a world where there are so many different pictures of the good, a pluralistic world? So here it's important to recognize that pluralism is an idea that matters on three different levels. The level of the individual human being, or the cognitive level, the social level, and then the institutional level. So at the cognitive level, as I've been saying, when we dig deep and do this work of reflection, we will find a variety of pictures of the good emerging. And people bring a variety of assets and capabilities to that work. So that's what I mean when I talk about pluralism on an individual level. At a social level, that very differentiation among individuals yields a diversity of social forms, different cultural modes, different ways of being in the world, just as you referred to in your invocation. You named exactly that feature of our beautiful humanity. So then the question is, how has collectives, where we're working so hard to understand the good and have such diverse pictures, how do we make decisions together? And that's where we come to institutional pluralism. Institutional pluralism is honestly just another fancy name for the project of self-government through the institutions of constitutional democracy. The point of constitutional democracy is to empower all of us to contribute to shaping our shared world. We figure out what matters to us and why, and we can shape our private worlds. But of course, that's not enough, because we live together under rules and constraints. So if we are going to actually experience empowerment, that opportunity for full unfolding of our human potential, we need also to contribute to shaping our common world. But the paradox of the institutions of constitutional democracy is that the results of collective decision-making can never line up perfectly with what any of us contributes in the first instance to the decision-making process. My will never line up perfectly with the will that comes out the end of the process of democratic decision-making. And that's for the simple fact that because of pluralism, the beautiful fruit of freedom, we find ourselves, through our institutions, involved in the work of negotiation, the work of compromise, of trying to achieve outcomes that we can broadly live with, knowing that sometimes we win and sometimes we lose. But in shaping the parameters of the conversation, we are shaping the world that we live in together. That's the reward of participating in democracy. So pluralism, then, has a meaning at these three different levels. My own individual contributions to thinking about what's good and all the ways that brings different pictures into the world, the fact that different cultural forms emerge, and then finally that in the institutions of freedom of self-government, we do the work of negotiating across our differences to achieve shared outcomes. And again, experience the paradox that none of us, not any single one of us, can have a result at the end of that process that lines up perfectly with our own will. In that regard, we truly share. So if that's what a confident pluralist is, then somebody who is confident in their own values, but also committed to the projects of pluralism, to the projects of free self-government for free and equal citizens through constitutional democracy, how does one become a confident pluralist? How does one carry this out? For this, I'm going to offer a five-step program. So the first step is about reflection. I'll name the steps and then come back to each of them, spending a different amount of time on each of them. So the first is reflection. The second is the commitment to the institutional processes by which we negotiate our differences, a commitment to constitutional democracy, and a commitment to nonviolence. That is a critical part of being a confident pluralist, that our differences are to be negotiated through institutions and in no other way. The third point is a commitment to compromise. The fourth is a commitment to listening and mirroring back before speaking, a commitment to listening over speaking. And the fifth commitment, coming back to my dad and my aunt, is to never let anybody hold hostage human dignity, to protect and preserve that. And by that, I mean it's time for us really to take a look at how we roll back our toxic cultures that have emerged. And I'll spend more time on that one as well. So coming back to reflection. Reflection is a practice. You're practicing it right now with me today. You're practicing it in these weekly forums and devotions. You're practicing it in the classrooms of the liberal arts campus community. It requires the work of philosophy, it requires theology, it requires literature to dig into the question of what matters to human beings and why, and what is the good life after all, the fundamental Socratic question, how should I live, how should we live? Those questions need to be regular parts of our lives for those of us who seek to be confident pluralists. Secondly, the commitment to institutions and negotiation. I name the fact that the commitment of a confident pluralist is to nonviolence because across our country, we are seeing increasing numbers of people who are forgetting that. They're forgetting that the project of free self-government requires seeing that institutions are the instruments that we use for negotiating our conflicts and our differences. It takes that in order to preserve that human potential whereby we can all unfold, steering our own lives, working together to steer our common lives. We unfold in our growth as human beings by working with each other through institutions to find negotiations and stable solutions. The third point is that that work, that commitment to institutions and to nonviolence, requires recognizing the value of compromise. And I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this one, because compromise is a word that for many people, it's in bad odor. People think that if you're going to compromise on something, it means you're giving something up. You're giving up core principles. And this isn't the case. There's a deeper meaning to compromise that I want to call your attention to. And to do that, I'm going to invoke the Declaration of Independence. This is a text in which several important compromises are built into the work of that important document. So I'm going to remind you about the all-important second sentence of the Declaration and ask you to spend some time reflecting on the lessons it has for us today about compromise. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. That's a really long sentence. And we often don't remember how long it is. And it's that long because it's telling us the whole story about what our responsibilities are as citizens. Yes, we have some rights. We have some examples of those rights. We have those as individuals. But the entire point is that we build our institutions in order to work together to affect our safety and happiness. And there are two important compromises in the Declaration that led the founders in that time in 1776 to be able to sign off unanimously on that document. One of those compromises I consider a good compromise, and one I consider a bad compromise. So I want to call your attention to those two compromises to help us start thinking about what is the difference between good compromise and bad compromise anyway. Which kind of compromise should we pursue? So the good compromise comes in how the Declaration engages with the language of religion. The Declaration uses the words of created, the divine providence, the supreme judge. These are all words that were open-ended in terms of which doctrinal set of commitments they were invoking. In addition, when the Declaration first lays out the moral foundations of its argument, it invokes the idea of nature's laws and nature's, the laws of nature's God, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Apologize. Freeze. Let me say that phrase again. It makes the case that its moral foundations lie on the laws of nature and nature's God. And that phrase is something like a belt and suspenders phrase. It was a phrase that let those people who were working on independence at that time, who were not themselves faithful, they weren't themselves committed to a deity, nonetheless, they could agree with the moral foundations on the basis of a commitment to nature's law. But for those who were faithful, for them, they had the chance to name that they saw the laws of nature as those of nature's God. The combination of these two moments in the Declaration give us a compromise where everybody then in the colonies, whether they were faithful or not, regardless of which religion they adhered to, had a way of affirming and connecting to the moral foundations of the text. Again, the language of creator, divine providence, supreme judge was open to many faiths. The language of the laws of nature and of nature's God was open to both the faithful and the unfaithful, in fact, the deists or the atheists among them. And working that way, they forged a compromise. Now, the second major compromise in the Declaration is in that long sentence that I recited for you, the phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The third part of that, pursuit of happiness, was replacing the word property. In the 18th century, the more common formulation for rights that needed to be invoked was that they needed to protect the rights of life, liberty, and property. But by the spring of 1776, as the founders were working on preparing for the Declaration, the concept of property had been closely connected to a defense of enslavement. As a result, it couldn't be used without necessarily signaling that the new entity, the United States of America, would in fact be committed to a defense of enslavement. But people who were working on the Declaration, like John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, were already against enslavement. They didn't want such a commitment to be anchored in that document. It was John Adams who led the case, made the argument for happiness as an alternative word. So the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is an anti-enslavement or an abolitionist moment in the Declaration. And indeed, Adams built on that language to help end enslavement in Massachusetts before the end of the Revolutionary War. At the same time that that moment of compromise emerged in the document, another moment also took place, what we could call as the pro-enslavement moment in the Declaration. The first draft had a passage in which the drafters criticized King George for violating the sacred rights of life and liberty of distant people in Africa. In other words, they used exactly the same vocabulary of sacred rights of life and liberty for Africans as they were using for themselves. But when Congress took the draft, Congress edited that passage out of the Declaration of Independence. It went too far for those who were slaveholders at the time. So the compromise in the Declaration around enslavement was on the one hand to use life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as an open-ended statement of goals and values, but on the other hand to cut out a statement that positively affirmed the rights of people in Africa. Now, I consider that one not a good compromise, and the contrast between the two, I think, is instructive. In that second compromise, it can't be said that the rights and interests of all who were affected by it were taken into account. The voices of enslaved people played no part in that decision making. So the first compromise around religion captured the voices of all those then in the colonies affected by the choices being made. The second compromise did not capture the voices of all those affected by the decision being made. And in that contrast, I think we can see a difference between good compromise and bad compromise. So a confident pluralist is somebody who, in public fora of decision-making, is ready to compromise with others. But when making those compromises, a confident pluralist wants to make sure that everybody who might be affected by the decision has a voice in the process. The purpose of bringing those voices together is for shared learning, for mutual learning, to see whether or not there's an alternative path to resolution that might not be visible if you don't have everybody's voices in the room together. So that was the third point in your five-step plan. We started with reflection, then we thought about committing to institutions and nonviolence. Now we've thought about compromise. The fourth step is about how we are with each other in these spaces when we are doing this hard work of negotiation. And here I said we have to prioritize listening and mirroring back to people over speaking. One finds often when people are in heated arguments with each other, it's frequently because they actually haven't understood each other in the first place. And one of the single most impactful things one can do for improving dialogue, improving debate, is to respond to a person first by repeating back to them what you think they've said, and then asking, "Is that what you meant? Have I got you right?" You'll find 9 times out of 10 they'll say, "No." And then the job will be to say, "Oh, okay, well, what did I miss? How can I adjust?" And the debate really shouldn't get started until both sides can tell the other what they think each other thinks and have each side agree that, yes, you've understood me correctly. And the odds are, by the time that you've gotten to the point of actually understanding each other correctly, there will be much less to debate. You will have found that the difference between you was not actually so great as you thought. And to the degree that there are still differences, you will have clarified precisely what they are, so that then you can actually engage with the ideas. And guard yourself against, in any way, attacking the other person. Now, there's nothing fancy in this advice, I will say, because you'll find if you talk to any marriage therapist, they will give precisely the same advice. Just repeat back, check that you've understood before you let your emotions overtake you to engage in hot or fiery argument. Now, that fourth part of the program is actually closely related to the fifth part. The fifth part, I said, was about never letting anybody hold human dignity hostage. And what do I mean by that exactly? Oftentimes, there are lots of people in our world who won't listen first. They'll just come at us in various ways with negative words or with bullying words or with problematic words. And when they do that, they're taking their own human dignity hostage. They have let go of who they are as their best selves. And they're also trying to take your human dignity hostage. They're trying to get a rise out of you. They're trying to keep you from keeping your own best self front and center. So the work of not letting other people take human dignity hostage is about responding to those moments of toxicity in a very different way than we see exhibited on our TV screens and in the news all the time. I'm going to give you a concrete example of what I mean by this, by reading to you an email exchange. I get a lot of nasty incoming email, a lot of name-calling, a lot of slurs, etc. I won't share the worst with you, but I'll just share one little one from this past November. And after it, I will then explain a little bit why I'm sharing this with you and what some of the lessons are that I've learned about how to avoid letting others hold human dignity hostage. So this one, and I'll make up the names of the person involved. This one came in with the subject line, "Aren't you ashamed?" Aren't you ashamed to be associated with an institution that supports anti-Semitism and terrorism? I don't know how you can sleep at night. You are a despicable human being. Dear Mr. Smith, thank you for your kind note. I wonder if you've taken the time to read my own contributions on the subject. If not, you'll find them here. And then I provided a link to one of my Washington Post columns. Best wishes, Danielle. Dr. Allen, thank you for responding and sending me your writings on this subject. I found it very sensible and thoughtful, and I obviously was not well informed about your thoughts on this. These are indeed difficult times, and sometimes one should spend more time thinking and taking a deep breath before lashing out at someone. Even better, though, please accept my apology. Thanks again for responding and educating me, Ray. Dear Ray, thank you very much for taking the time to read my piece, for writing back again, and for your apology. You've made my day. It's my birthday, and this note is a great birthday present. With appreciation, Danielle. Dr. Allen, let me then wish you a very happy birthday and hope you do something very special for yourself. Even though I lashed out in hostility towards you, you turned the interaction into something very positive and taught me something about myself. I guess that's why you're a professor. If only everyone could do the same thing, we'd live in a better world. I hope at the very least I brought a little smile to your face on your special day. You're one of the lights you wrote about in your article. Thanks again and happy birthday. So why do I share that? I share that because, as I said, I have gotten so much incoming negativity over time. And I began over time to realize it was affecting me as a human being. It was making me more guarded, less kind, less open to the world. I realized my human dignity was being held hostage. That was unacceptable to me. So I decided that every time I received a negative message, I would meet it with the most open, welcoming, warm spirit I possibly could. That I would not let my own human dignity be held hostage. And then the most surprising thing happened. When I started responding to people that way, 9 times out of 10, they turned back into their best selves, just as Ray did in this exchange. He pivoted faster, I will admit, than some of my correspondents. That was an unusually fast turn. But he also apologized, and he recognized implicitly that he had been holding human dignity, his own human dignity, hostage. So this is my last prong of my five-point plan for you for how to be a confident pluralist. The last is not to let anybody hold human dignity hostage. And above all, that requires overcoming one's own sense of being taken aback, of being attacked, overcoming that and meeting that always with love and generosity. Thank you again for opening your space to me. It's been an honor to be with you this morning.